Blog Talk Radio.
أشهد أن لا إله إلا الله. أشهد أن لا إله إلا الله. أشهد أن محمد رسول الله. أشهد أن محمد رسول الله. حي على الفلاح. حي على الفلاح. حي على الفلاح.
Come here together as Muslims on this military base of the United States Army of the United States of America military. And I tell you, brothers, that it's a wonderful thing, because every base that's in the United States military organization does not have a Salatul Jumma. We wish that it was different, but every base does not have a Salatul Jumma. It was not easy over 40 years ago to establish the Salat al-Jumma on this base. It was not easy. It was a struggle. And it's still a struggle, because we haven't really gotten it established to the extent that we would like to. I've been imam here with the exception of a short break where I worked as a senior imam, but we had another brother that was mostly doing the khutbahs, and when he wasn't available, then I would fill in. But I was always the one that was responsible, I guess you could say, to make sure that we kept the Jumma going. And I've been doing this now for almost 19 years.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuhu. الحمد لله نمهده ونستعينه ونستغفره ونعوذ بالله من شرور أنفسنا ومن سيئات أعمالنا من يهد الله فلا مضل له ومن يضلل فلا هادي له وأشهد أن لا إله إلا الله وحده لا شريك له وأشهد أن محمدا عبده ورسوله. All praise is due to Allah. We praise Him and we ask for His help and we ask for His protection. And we seek safety in Allah from the weakness in our own selves, in our own souls, and from the evil of the things that we do. And whoever Allah guides, there is no one who can lead him or her astray. And whoever Allah finds deviating, whoever Allah finds in error, there is no one to guide him or her. And I bear witness that there is no God but Allah, and that Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam is his servant and his messenger. Dear Muslims, today we want to talk briefly, but we want to cover two things. And the first thing we're going to cover is the message from the Quran, from the surah entitled Al-Furqan, which talks about self-control. And so we're going to read this in the English interpretation. So we need to realize that this is a time, not only in America, but throughout the world, when people need to learn how to practice self-control, because the Satan is working very, very hard, working hard from within our own nafs, using the daifan part of our own nafs. You know, there's weakness in all of us. Allah says He created us weak. Not that we should enjoy being weak, not that we should remain weak, but Allah gives us guidance to help us become stronger the same way, not necessarily the same way. I'll just use this example. If you want to learn how to become stronger physically, you might hire a physical training coach. And that physical training coach, he will give you certain exercises and he will give you certain tests. And as you develop, you'll notice that your strength has increased and your weakness has decreased. Well, That's good, because it lets you know that you have a good trainer. If he's giving you exercises that help you get stronger. Well, Allah's the best of trainers, and he has given us Prophet Muhammad.
And we begin our talk tonight. Booker T. Washington speaks, African American Family Forum, with a short extract from a religious sermon that we gave on yesterday. And the emphasis of that sermon was becoming stronger, morally stronger, and spiritually stronger, and intellectually stronger through the grace of God. We're going to shift to our main topic now for tonight. Should all African American children encourage to seek a college education? Should all African American children be encouraged to seek a college education, or is vocational technical training just as good? And I just want to begin, before we bring on our panelists, I want to begin by just mentioning a couple of things. Number one is a great intellectual, a great civil rights leader, W.E.B. Du Bois, Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois, wrote a classic study of the freed Americans entitled Black. To 1880. And I just want to mention something important. Everything he wrote was important, but I want to mention something very important that he wrote in this book, which was originally published in 1935. Dr. Du Bois lived a very long life. I think he was about 93 years old when he passed, but as a young man, he was very intellectually advanced. And so he talks about the disenfranchisement of the Negro. The African-American people were given the right to vote by the 15th Amendment. The 13th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution freed the former slaves, African-American people in slavery, from forced bondage, case of being sentenced to prison. And the 14th Amendment gave citizenship, American citizenship, to the African-American people who theretofore had not been included in the population eligible for citizenship, but the 14th Amendment changed that. And then the 15th Amendment gave the African Americans, along with many others, the right to vote. And Dr. Du Bois was very critical of Booker T. Washington's position concerning seeking the enforcement of the law of the United States, which gave the black people the right to vote, because during the time when Booker T. Washington was a spokesman or leader for black people, white people were using unlettered, uneducated, and illiterate black people to vote according to the way they wanted the vote to go. And many of these black people depended on these white people for the ability to make a living, to even live on the property that the white people had owned when the black people were slaves and still owned after slavery. So Dr. Bois, he critically praised Booker T. Washington's position, and he said that this brings us to the situation when Booker T. Washington became the leader of the Negro race and advised them to depend upon industrial education and work rather than politics. The better class of Southern Negroes stopped voting for a generation. And then with the shift of population toward the north, there comes the present situation. And this is as of around 1930-35, when out of 12 million Negroes, 3 million are in the north and 9 million in the south. Those in the north and in border states vote. Those in the south are seriously restricted in their voting. And this restriction means that their political power is exercised by the white South, which gives the white South an extraordinary political influence as compared with the voters of the North and East. The disenfranchisement of Negroes in the South became nearly complete. In no other civilized land, no other civilized and modern land has so great a group of people, most of whom were able to read and write, been allowed so small a voice in their own government. Every promise of eventual recognition of the intelligent Negro has been broken. I'm going to stop right there because this is actually a segue into our topic tonight. And I'll repeat the topic. Should all African-American children be encouraged to seek a college education, or is vocational technical training just as good? Dr. Du Bois is from an educated background. He attended Fisk University and received a bachelor's degree, and then he went to Harvard and received another bachelor's degree and then a doctorate degree. And then he also was fortunate to study as a graduate student in Germany. So he was very highly educated and very intellectual, and he spoke for the intellectual college-educated, predominantly college-educated class of Negroes during this time. And he called this predominantly educated group because he was encouraging the young Black Americans to strive to be members of the talented 10th. He felt that Booker T. Washington was wrong, that he was betraying the cause of freedom, justice, and equality for the Black people by encouraging the Black people to seek vocational, technical, educational opportunities and provide economic foundations for their communities. And then once they have a stable economic situation, then for those people who had the gift to acquire college education to go on and get the education, because Booker T. Washington said, what good is it to encourage our young people to become lawyers, poor sharecroppers, don't have the money to pay for legal services. So let's build up a community of people who are industrious, who have money in the bank, who have homes and can afford the services of the professional class, before we start pushing our people towards occupations that, at least in the South, may be very restricted to us. So this is the argument. And even today, now, we see a dearth of African Americans going into industry, building entrepreneurial enterprises where they can actually hire others, not just Black people, but others as well. But yet it seems that the whole trend now is to encourage all of the children to seek a college education. And let me just finish by saying this. I love the work that I do for a living. I'm a college professor. And one of the things that makes me love it so much is because I'm able to mentor a lot of African-American young people. They come to me because they know that I care about them. I also mentor white children or white young people as well. But it seems like I'm a special magnet for the African-American children. Some of them come from broken homes. Some of them see me as a father or grandfather figure, and that's fine. But the thing about it is I have a young lady who's one of my students who asked if she could speak to me about the class that she just enrolled in that I teach. And then conversing with her, she told me she really didn't like She really didn't like school. Now, history is not a difficult subject, but it's not necessarily an easy A subject, at least the way I teach it. And so she contacted me this evening, and she wanted me to look at an essay that she turned in that was due today. And I looked at it, and the first thing I noticed is that she had not followed the directions for setting up the format of the paper. And I asked her, I said, did you read my directions? And she said, no, she had not taken the time to read the directions. Well, I did not scold her harshly because she had already warned me. She didn't care about school. So I said, well, what I'd like for you to do is go ahead and read all the directions that I gave pertaining to this assignment. And then try to follow those directions and then revise your essay. And after you've done that, then resubmit it and then we'll talk about it. Because I'm trying to encourage her not just so that she can graduate from college, but so that regardless of what she chooses to do, she can learn the rules of life in terms of being responsible. And that's what Booker T. Washington was trying to do. He was trying to teach our people to be responsible, whether you go to college or whether you go to a trade school. You should learn how to be successful in whatever you're doing. What we're going to do, and I'm going to turn it over, we have a number of people that have joined us, so I'm getting ready to turn it over to you who have joined us. But what I'm going to do for the second half of this broadcast is I'm going to play a very famous speech that Booker T. Washington gave 6 months before he was assassinated. He gave this speech in Philadelphia at a middle school, or what we call today also junior high school. And the topic of this speech was, what is your life's blueprint? And I will be doing a reenactment, God willing, of this speech here in a small town in Georgia on Monday, in celebration of Booker T. Washington, in celebration of Martin Luther King's holiday. But I want you all to hear Martin Luther King himself, because I do have it recorded, and I'm going to play it in the second half, so stay tuned. So having said all that, now we'd like to go ahead and turn the program over to our regular panelists and guests. And first of all, of course, we want to welcome Dr. Well, that's fine. Mr. Bianchi, you've been waiting for quite a while. And then after that, Sister Viana, you've been waiting for a few minutes. And then our guest also from the 910 area code. And I believe that's my fraternity brother, Dr. Calvin Nobles, who actually invited me to come to his hometown on Monday to give this talk. So we're going to go ahead. And in the order that people have actually appeared on the studio call-in list, we're going to ask you to introduce yourself if you would like to and comment on the topic. Should all African-American children be encouraged to seek a college education, or is vocational technical training just as good? So let us hear from you. Mr. Pianchi, how are you doing this evening, sir?
Man, we got like 65 degrees, 70 degree temperatures here. I'm doing very good. A little rain, but it's better than what's up at north.
You're still down in Louisiana?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have a home here.
Yeah. It's been warm here today in Augusta, Georgia. We've had some nice weather. It was foggy today, and so as a result, I didn't get out to go out with my golf trainer and play golf, and I regret that because he's been wanting to get me out there so he can teach me a few skills, even though he says I do well, but he wants to take me to another level. So I stayed inside because the weather was foggy, but it was nice out there. I saw later on it cleared up, and my neighbor had a little barbecue, but I'm glad that the weather's nice where you are. So what do you think about the topic, Mr. Bianchi?
Well, the people should go through the process to see what their young people, parents and families should go through the process to see what their young people have potential in. Whether it's, you know, everybody can't be in trades. What are you going to do? You're going to have 11 million plumbers and you're going to go into the commercial trades, the five basic trades, iron workers, carpentry, sheet metal, cement finishing, and laborers. So, no, you should go through, treat that just as you would, trying to come up with a decision on what the best automobile to buy. Black, the population that we call black, although there's subgroups in it, and I think black itself is a subgroup. And really, I don't know what it means. But when you look at certain industries and categorical professions, this subgroup that we call black should at least be present in those areas at a percentage equal to their percentages in the overall population. In your service fields and social work, they are overrepresented. When you come down to earth sciences, applied mathematics, not just mathematics, but applied mathematics in the fields that they curtail, in particular medicine and the engineering, they don't represent their population. They don't represent a percentage in those fields that they are in the population of the country. And you look at the some sites like a Nesby site where they post jobs. They have like, I think I checked today, they had like 10,000 different jobs that's not being fulfilled. You look at the scholarships that's set aside and specifically for members of this group, that money is being left on the table. Trade schools cost. They're not free like they used to be. In the 60s, they had trade school, high schools. They had a trade school, high school in St. Louis that offered everything from pre-engineering, aero mechanics, auto mechanics. It offered bakery. It offered newspaper press, electrical, sheet metal. It offered pre-engineering. He even offered beautician. They don't have those schools no more. Now you have to pay for that. And those costs are high. Those same scholarships, I imagine they could also be used to attend something like that. So I think it's up to the individual. It's up to the child, importantly. But I think my overall answer would be yes for the colleges. And I think that those STEM degrees should be a priority for those families that have the forewithal and the functionality to steer their children into those areas. So, General, that's my question. That's my answer.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Mr. Bianchi. And I just want to say this, and then I'm going to ask Sister Baina if you would like to respond. And hopefully Dr. Nobles will come back on. He was on waiting, but he had to leave. I'm sure he's interested in the topic. Hopefully he will come back. But anyway, before you start to explain, let me just mention this. I grew up at Tuskegee Institute when it was a multi-purpose institution. On the one hand, it was a trade school, and on the other hand, it was a classical college educational institution. They gave degrees up through the master's degree in several fields, and they also taught a number of trades at one point in time. I believe they were teaching over 30 different trades. I'm not pleasant teaching as many of those trades when I went to school there, but I remember when I was growing up there, one of the joys of my childhood was going to the trade departments and seeing the students learning these vocations. And one of the trade departments that I used to spend a lot of time or would visit as a child, and I'm talking about 11 years old, 12 years old, maybe younger. In fact, I think I started as young as 9 years old. My mother took me by there, and that was the printing shop. And I became fascinated by printing because there were always a lot of books in my home, and I was encouraged to read. And so I became very much attached to books. And so when I went to the printing shop, one of the men that ran the printing shop, one of the instructors there, gave me a lesson in how to do printing on an old-fashioned movable type printing press. And then later I got the idea that I would become a book publisher, which I have published actually 5 books so far. And it's one of the great joys of my life that that dream came true. And that's a trade. Now, of course, you know, I had to have an education to learn how to edit books. I had to know grammar. I had to know language. I even know how to, had to know how to write well, because 4 of the books that I published are my own books that I wrote. So I went to college, and I did get a degree in English and creative writing from a very, very prestigious state research university where I'm also employed now as a professor. So I actually experienced sides of the coin. One is that I basically taught myself the trade of book publishing, and of course went to college to learn how to actually become a professional writer. But when I went and it closed out is when I went to high school, the school that I went to was built on the what I would say model of Tuskegee. It was an all-African-American school. We had some people that technically might have been considered Caucasians because we did have some people that were considered Latinos there. But the fact of it is that all of us had to learn a trade. In addition to the college preparatory studies, we all had to learn a trade. And the trade that I learned was electronics and electricity. And when I graduated from there, because of the college prep training, I was able to get a full scholarship to go to Yale and also a full scholarship to go to Princeton, as well as 4 of the most prestigious African-American colleges, including Howard and Morehouse and Xavier and Lincoln. But I actually went to the University of California, Berkeley, which was considered the Ivy League school of the West Coast. And so I had the best of both worlds, because the electronics training that I received there gave me a foundation for a career that spanned 24 years in the United States Navy, where I became an information systems technician. And in the course of that career, I also became a computer repairman and a network troubleshooter. And so I got both sides of the coin. So if someone were to ask me that question, I would say similar to what you said, Ms. Bianchi, but I'd add a different little twist on it. I would say it depends on the interests and aptitudes of the child, because my mother wanted me to go to college. She was at one of my graduations when I received the degree in English, and she was very excited that I did receive that degree. But the fact is that she was happy that I became a writer. She never lived to see me become a book publisher, however. But the truth of the matter is that it was she that took me to the printing shop to see people working in that trade of publishing books. And so the thing that I want to say as I close is that when she was working on her master's degree in education as a counselor, she had an assignment to give a test to someone which was an aptitude skills interest test, and she gave the test to me. And because she was able to, using this valid testing method, she was able to see where my talent and my interest was. And as a result, she continued to encourage me in that direction. I'm not saying that every child is going to have a mother that's going to be a counselor, but most of the children go to schools where they do have counselors that should be giving these children tests, and they should use these tests to help to steer these children. And I personally don't believe, especially after working with a lot of African-American children that really do not love education. They don't really want their classical educational studies that they have to have in order to get a classical educational degree. I think there should be an alternative. I'm not saying they should not have a certificate or a piece of paper saying they're qualified for a job, but the classical college education, I've come to the conclusion, not only for the black kids, but for a lot of white kids, it's not fit what they're interested in. So much for my monologue. We're going to go ahead. Sister Bain, I'm going to ask you to be patient with me for just a minute. I'd love to hear what you have to say. And I know
okay. That
you say something very, but I want to ask Dr. Knowles because he's a very, very, as we all are, busy professional person, and he had to leave for a minute. And while we got him here, I would like to ask him if he wants to just respond in case he has to leave again. Dr. Knowles, I believe that's you from the 910 area code. If it is, please go ahead. If not, we certainly will like to hear from the one who is from 910 area code. Is that you, Dr. Knowles?
I'm in a 910 area code. I don't know. My name is Nibs. Knibbs. Is that what you're reading?
You go ahead.
Okay.
But do me a favor.
Yeah.
Since you've been on for a minute, let me hear your response. And then, Sister, please forgive me, but be patient with me because I'd like to, hear from our gentleman since he came and left, and I want to have him speak before he has to go away again.
Fine.
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah.
Is that okay, go ahead, sir.
You want me to? Okay. Now, I just called in because a sister, Christine, encouraged me to call into the program about the question of vocational and college education. And I agreed with the comment that was made that it depends on the aptitude of the child. But, so rather than say, well, we're going to encourage all of the children, all of our young people to go in a certain direction, we should encourage, it's like flowers, you water them and encourage them to be what they are. But I feel called upon to question is, like in the scriptures, Moses was in the house of Pharaoh as an infant, but he was prevented from nursing, right? And so we are all nursed in the house of Pharaoh, and we need to be weaned of that. We're seeing everything in terms of how to fit into the house of Pharaoh, right? To get jobs, to get this, to get that. And it's a good strategy, but we need to see it in terms of, as collectively as a people, that we have a life that is, outside of Pharaoh's plans. And so, we have an economy that goes up, goes down, you have unemployment, you have all of these kinds of things. One of the things I liked about being a follower of Elijah Muhammad is that, because I immersed myself in that, I worked at the Shabazz restaurant and everything, is that we had a Nation of Islam money. It was a regular dollar bills, but we didn't have the inflation and all of that. And when the fish program got going, we didn't have the unemployment. I'm just saying that we need to think outside of that box. We get into, we get these degrees, and then, I'm happy I got a degree before I joined the Nation of Islam, but as a practical matter, I had that piece of paper. But we need to think, beyond that, because the purpose of the universities is to prepare people to serve the corporate oligarchy. So, we need to understand that's what they're doing. So, I'll stop.
Well, we saw, thank you, brother, and I said, assalamu alaikum. And you know, I follow the Honorable Muhammad, and I'm still following the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. I'm not in the organization now that's headed by Minister Farrakhan, who's a personal friend of mine, but that's beside the point. The main thing is that I'm a very dedicated follower of the teaching of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, and one of the things that he encouraged me to do is to form my own business. And I just want to say this very briefly, but I had gone to college for a number of years. I had not received my degree yet, but because of the years of college that I had, the AT&T, the big oligarchic telephone industrial giant, hired me as a communications engineer. And it was basically a combination of engineering and marketing position, and they gave me the best account in the whole area of the Bay Area of California, working with the largest company. And I was able to enjoy a certain amount of prestige that it took some of the other people 20 years to achieve. And I might have been, you know, given it equal opportunity efforts. But the fact is that during that time, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad was encouraging us to do a couple of things. One is to start our own businesses, and the other is to go to study engineering and technology. And I had been in the pre-law program at Berkeley, but I decided that I didn't want to do that anymore. And so I actually was accepted into that school of engineering. But after being with the AT&T and learning the ropes for about a year and a half, I decided to form my own communications business, and I called it Your Telephone Company. That was one of the logos that the Elijah Muhammad encouraged us to put on our businesses to bring our people into an affiliation with the fact that we were doing it for them. And so I called it Your Telephone Company, and it made me feel great to dress up in the business clothes that I wore for AT&T and go into corporate offices and show them my card, letting them know I was doing for self. But you see, this all based so much on the classical college studies that I had received, but it was based on the encouragement of Elijah Muhammad to learn some technical skill so that I could develop my own business. And that's my life story. But anyway, I want to go ahead and thank you, brother. And I want to ask Sister Baina, what do you think about the topic? Should all African-American children be encouraged to seek a college education, or is vocational technical training just as good?
I want to just say, you know, peace and blessings to everybody online. I hope everybody's doing well, wherever they are. And you know, African American children are such a unique new people on the planet, first of all. And I don't know necessarily if we all have a family unit. I'm like Dr. Cressing. She likes to refer to black families as survival units. And I think that today, pretty much, African American children are living in survival units. But what I think is, I agree with you that there should be some counseling somewhere, guidance. I think that our young people need to have the opportunity to be informed, to weigh their options, to be informed as to statistics for job placement. They need to have opportunity to weigh their options with a guidance counselor to decide if they want a quick path to a high-paying career, or if they're just trying to decide if they want to attend a technical college, a community college, a college, or university. I don't even know if they even know what all those things mean. That's why we need counseling in schools now. They don't know the difference between the ACT and the SAT, okay? Not only African American children, period. I mean, you know, our children are being dumbed down in these school systems. Better, you know, we need to help them to decide what's better for your future, you know. Don't just make assumptions about somebody. Give them options. Focus on exact training or certification and skills that may be needed for them to start a career. They need guidance, you know. They need a path to guidance. They need to have understanding as to what all of this is all about, because they're still young. They're little seeds, like the brother was saying. You know, they're like flowers. They're seeds. You got to put water on them. If you don't put no water on them, how are they going to grow? They're going to know which direction to grow in. They're going to mutate. You know, something can happen to them along the way. And they need to understand that going to school is about discovering who you are and what exactly it is that you really want to do. Because we've all worn, I've worn many hats, you know. One of my friends asked a question the other day, asked everybody, what did you want to be when you grew up? I wanted to be an interior decorator. Well, I worked for an interior decorator, and then after I worked for an interior decorator, so I got, you know, we're still in my team. I realized that even working for an interior decorator, each one of those people that works there as interior decorators, they specialize in something. And framing pictures, doing chairs, drapery, something, you know. Maybe the person that owns the firm might do it all, but they tend to have people work for them who specialize in something. So we need to help our children to understand, what do you want to do exactly? What kind of training? You know, we have to expose them to things. And I think that's the job of the guidance counselor and the parent. You know, people want their children to go to be doctors and lawyers and Indian chiefs or whatever. But what does a child really want to do? We need to help children to focus. And we're in the 21st century, so we have to have rapidity and we have to have comprehension. That's all I have to say about that. And that's not just for African-American children. That's for all children. That's for a global. We need to put this on a global scale, not just localized school systems. We need to have global education.
Thank you, Sister Baina. Thank you very much. And we have another caller who has been one of our regular visitors to the program, who was on for just a few minutes waiting, but then something must have come up and she had to drop off, and hopefully she'll come back quickly because of the fact that we have only about less than 15 minutes for this part of the program, because the second out of the program, I actually wanted to play the recording of the speech by Martin Luther King on What Is Your Life Blueprint, because of the fact that we archive these programs and people can go back up online even months later. We've got about 2 years' worth of archive programs, and they can hear these programs. So for those who weren't able to hear this conversation tonight, especially what you have said, but also what they will hear from the lips of Martin Luther King, so to speak, because it will be his own voice. I wanted to make sure we get that in, so later on I can invite people to go up on our website and to be able to hear him as well as you. So what we're going to do right now, I was hoping that our sister who had dropped off a few minutes ago would return so we could hear her. She's a retired educator, and I know that she would probably have some vision.
Well,
but go ahead.
Let's look at it like this. This is a conversation that you're having on January the 19th. Last month, people had conversations saying that blacks need to have and control their own manufacturing and destiny. Then you have others having conversations talking about that the Chinese is recolonizing Africa, and they're taking African resources. Well, someplace along the line, unless we want to also admit that these folks that's talking is talking based on their own self-interest. But if you're talking about solving these problems that we acclaim that others are creating. And really, when you say United States is stealing resources out of Africa, that ain't the United States government. That's companies that have came into some agreement with the country that they're in. And blacks could have companies that do the same thing. But you have to have people that are astute and skilled in those areas. If you're going to mine copper, you need to have geologists. You need to have chemical engineers. You need chemists. If you're going to produce electricity, we talk about we need to have solar energy and all that stuff. Solar energy derived by photovoltaic, by wind energy, by wave energy in the oceans. You got to have electrical engineers. We have to have automotive engineers because you hear them talking about autonomous vehicles that drive themselves. You hear talks about electrical vehicles doing away with gasoline engines as much as we possibly can. You have to have automotive engineers. If you're going to manufacture, you need to have industrial engineers in order to make sure that the manufacturing is going on at the highest level of proficiency so that your investors will get their greatest return and also the timely return. You have to have industrial technicians. That's their job. So just on those few things I mentioned, you don't learn that in high school. We talk about diseases. Heck, they've been talking about solving sickle cell anemia. I remember them talking about it when I was in high school. Well, apparently the researchers that's researching diseases that plague certain ethnic groups, they're not studying on how to cure sickle cell anemia, which affects blacks in America and this part of the world hemisphere more so than other places. So you have to have research facilities set up in your colleges so that black kids can participate. Mental health. You have to have psychiatrists, psychologists. You have to have people that are involved in the perfection of medicines, psychotropic drugs, techniques. You don't learn that in high school. So if those aren't to be considered what I just mentioned, that's a short list. Not including opportunities that exist. Aerospace engineers, U.S. Department of Labor reported there's going to be a shortage of over 250,000 pilots in the commercial and also the military. You don't learn that in high school. So looking at the median income of blacks, which is around $30,000-some-odd, $34,000-$35,000, then you hear reports that say it's going to take 228 years for blacks to catch up with whites. Well, you're surely not going to do that in your humanities. Having jobs in psychology and, you know, those areas. So if we don't, if the idea is not preparing your young people, and you just can't let young people decide on their own, why is that? Because they're under peer pressure. Young people are going to take the easy way out. And if that's not true, then why come you have blacks overrepresented in low-paying majors? Are they there because that's what they decided to do? Then when you look at Indians, why are they so highly represented in your medical fields? That's paying $250, $75,000 a year. Why are they there? You think that they coming out of a poverty situation, they just so happily woke up one morning and say, I want, no, they have programs that's going on that has been installed and in place to direct their young people into those fields so that they can do what? Capture the dollars. African immigrants here qualify for things that black Americans don't qualify. And there's a demand and hoop and holler that you don't have enough blacks, you don't have enough blacks. Well, they hear that message too. So they say, well, hell, if black Americans are not stepping up and they want somebody black, my skin is black, guess what? I'm going to take advantage of this. 40% of black males on your Ivy League colleges are Nigerians. So if you don't prepare for directing your young people into those areas, then why have the conversations in these other things? Whites is taking over Africa. Chinese is taking over Africa. Mideasterners in our community running gasoline marks and all that stuff. I mean, is that an honest question that I'm asking, Mr. Washington?
But I certainly agree with everything you said, and I do appreciate everything you said. And I just want to share some with you, and then we want to bring on a very special guest who's been on before. And I say that he's special because he was part of a development of an educational system that the needs that we have, in light of what you said, from a different perspective than what even wise men like W.E.B. Du Bois said before him on. I just want to read something that someone very close to him actually wrote. This person who I'm going to introduce in just a second is the grandson of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. And the Honorable Elijah Muhammad said, and you can find it in his very, very classic and important work, The Fall of America, which this would be found on this publication on page 97. He says, America's educational system has never benefited you and me. Now, I don't mean, and I'm sure he didn't mean, that we weren't able to get a J-O-B as a result of the system, but that's not what he was talking about. He was talking about in terms of community life or collective benefit. He says, America's educational system has never benefited you and me, only to keep us slaves to the white man. We, the black people, want an educational system that will bring us into unity as a man before Allah. And he puts parentheses God, because we're speaking of God when we say the word Allah. He says, we want an educational system that we can lead in the light of ancient and modern history, and we want an educational system, and I think this is the key point here, we want an educational system that will guide us through tomorrow, not an educational system that is dying today. And of course, when he wrote this, this was at the height of what we call the hippie movement, when many hundreds and thousands of very intelligent white people were rebelling against their education at some of the major universities of the United States. But I think that point that he made is still relevant. We do need an educational system that will guide us.
Well,
please let Mr. Mm-hmm. Muhammad come on, and after he has a few minutes, come on back. Okay. So at this time, I'd like to bring on our special guest, and all of you are very special. Every one of you is special. But I'd like to bring on the grandson of the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad, Minister Jesus Muhammad Ali. Brother Minister, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam, and thank you for the beautiful introduction. I wanted to compliment the brother on the statistics that he was able to bring to the forefront, and that's a very pragmatic way about doing anything, is you first try to solicit statistics in order to validate the position. But I want to say this in conjunction with the point that my grandfather was making in that article too, which in some ways, I think, what was the brother's name who originally was explaining about the disparity of the kind of jobs that black people take and the average medium income as averse to, like, people from India. What was the brother? What was your name again, brother?
His name is Mr. Piyaki.
Mr. Piyaki, yes, sir. I just want to be sure I acknowledge him by his name. Any case, it's a very good point you make, but you were pointing to how black people seldom take advantage of these opportunities. But I think that what my grandfather is saying in that article really speaks to that, because most black people in this country, you know, they allow people to direct them as to what vocations and what kind of education, if you know, they should go into, rather than to. But like people from India, though, you got to remember, India is you're talking about a country that's a population of 1 billion people. And yes, you are 100% correct in terms of the fact that they are being guided, you know, in terms of what kind of vocations they should go into, in hopes to be able to garner dollars. And then this country, when it comes to immigrants, you know, they have, you know, they get preferential treatment if they are they have certain scholastic, you know, ratings in various areas, you know. So all of that is part and parcel, but yes, that is correct too. And then you mentioned how these Arabs come over here buying up these gas stations and other dollar stores. Yes, that's correct, you know, but all of it's correct. But the thing is that just like President Reagan in his he was running for office, he came to office as a pragmatist, and he provided all of these statistics, you know, very much like the brothers doing now, statistic based. That's a pragmatic way by which to charter a direction going forward, you know, which is a highly respected way of doing things. But one of the things that President Reagan pointed out was how, you know, in the black community, at that time, we had a buying power of $140 billion. Today, I think it's $1.2 trillion. But what he was saying, as it applies to that statistic, is that in the black community, African-American community, that money doesn't turn over even a half of a time. Now, that's when President Reagan was running for office. Okay, and now I think they said it might turn over one time, but they say in the average community it turns over 7 times. In the Asian community, it turns over 21 times before that same dollar comes back into mainstream. See, so what I'm saying is, you know, our whole, you know, like my grandfather was saying, is the educational system is not designed to educate you in areas that's going to allow you to have any self-sufficiency. So even the publication of that article was only a representation of to other racial groups when they come here. That's the reason why you find most of them, they settle in our communities, because they know that we are one of the biggest consumers in this country, because you know, that's even reflected in the fact that the money doesn't turn over even a half a time. They have a self-conscious. We don't have a self-conscious, because we are constantly trying to show that we don't have a bias, you know. And there's another article I was reading in the back in, I think it was in 86, I think it was. It was in a Reader's Digest. They were saying America being mauled to death, and how the demographic of America itself was originally designed to where it had any given community would be somewhat autonomous. You have a hardware, a supermarket, and then there would be developed a sense of a family. You know they know you, you know them. But now it's going to come to be a situation where they say America being mauled to death. They're saying they put in all these different malls, and it's even now, and that was in 86, and we are now dealing with a demographic that relates to the internet, and that means you can shop, and you can FedEx will deliver something to you almost straight from China almost, because China's only about 14, 16 hours away by jumbo jet. Our fidelity is to the dollar and maximizing our dollar return. And in maximizing our dollar return, black people are not in a position like Walmart, a multi-billion-dollar corporation like Amazon, a multi-billion-dollar corporation. Okay, they, of course, you're not even going to be in a position to compete with them. That's the whole point. They keep you in a position where, as you are, but all of this, I don't like to make it appear as though, I'm trying to say it's their fault. Matter of fact, my grandfather, what he tried to do, and much of what he tried to do, was to demonstrate how we can become self-sufficient, and we have to have a sense of self. You know what I mean? He opened up, like I was raised, there was a cleaning plant, supermarkets, bakeries, I worked in all of those different businesses. Before I decided which area I've had a particular interest in and a proclivity towards in a sense of self, and that was I wound up in the bakery business. That's how I raised my children as a baker, and managing a bakery. I started out when I was 7 years old, but as far as black people are concerned, usually whatever your father is, then that's the trade that you choose. But all of those notions, especially in the black community, all of those notions are non-existent. But you in other ethnic groups, what I'm saying, moreover, let me put it like this, moreover, and you were making a very good point, because you said we have to try to direct our young people. This is exactly what, but the problem, one of the biggest problems we have today, though, is that young people, because of some people call Sheikh Google, Sheikh only means honorable, Sheikh Google, all they got to do is see, if they can Google something. And I oftentimes take advantage of the fact that people do have that ability because they don't have the background that I have in terms of research. So therefore, I don't want to make my audience feel like I'm trying to take advantage of them. But nowadays, I just go ahead and tell them exactly what I have to say, because I know that if they want, they're in a position that all they got to do is Google what I say and be able to find out, am I misleading them? Otherwise, I feel uncomfortable sharing the information because I don't want to make anyone feel as though I'm just taking advantage of somebody by telling them something. But they can easily nowadays Google it. But by virtue of being able to easily Google something nowadays, oftentimes that puts parents in an awkward position, because a lot of times parents may not be as computer literate as their children are. So therefore, but the biggest problem with this is that the children are not looking to their parents. Okay, therefore they're not seeking direction from their parents, which is what you are advancing, because other cultures, your children, you know, because the parents has laid the foundation for the child. So therefore, you know, in most other cultures, the child has a sense of enough respect to know that their parents have laid a foundation for them. Whereas in this whole idea that came out about we are the world, okay, nowadays children, you know, there's a very church, you know, hand in the face kind of attitude, is that they don't need your direction, they don't need your guidance, okay, and that's to the parent becomes hurtful, you know, for one thing, and then they kind of withdraw, and then the child, you know, so I'm gonna let him, you know, a hard head makes for a soft behind, so I'm gonna let him run into the problems. But the thing about it is, you know, all of this speaks to a disconnect, and then their failure constitutes our failure, because they represent us going forward. Okay, as far as, you know, the next generation, you know. And so anyway, I don't, you know, I just want to comment on, you know, the article, and that's the reason why my grandfather sent us to parochial school. You know, I started at 3.5 years old. We both started 4 years old. Most of us graduated high school, which is 8 years, you know, grammar school, and 4 years high school. Most of us graduated by 16. I was in college by 17 years old, you know what I mean? But by then, I had a sense of self. And also, one of the things that was promoted, you know, in the University of Islam where I attended was deductive reasoning, okay, and which is, you know, when somebody brings something to you, you know what I mean, you have to look at it through that prism of evaluation, okay, and then, two, you know, always be leery of someone, you know, coming up with hypotheticals, okay, try to stay away from people using a lot of hypotheticals, you know, because the reality is enough for us to try to grapple with, rather than to start having someone to use a bunch of hypotheticals. Whereas pragmatic, you know, just like that's the reason why this country believes, and the government believes so and relies so heavily upon statistics, okay, you know, and that's the reason why I had, you know, become very, you know, careful about how I fill out, you know, these census, okay, I respect my Native American lineage as much as my African American lineage. But I think Warren Buffett did a study. He wanted to say that, you know, 70% of black people in this country have European blood, which, you know, speaks to the fact that many of our great grandmothers, you know, they were strapped over bedposts and taken like a horse in a stall originally, until, you know, they became, you know, adapted to the system, and you have, you know, have maybe they were not so aggressively taken, but they, you know, the women saw an opportunity to advance their lot in life, you know, by association with the dominant society. Okay, well, I'm gonna give the floor to anyone else who wants to address that, and any comment they want to make as well.
Well, we certainly thank you, Brother Minister Jesus Muhammad Ali, my dear friend and brother. And we're going to invite those who have stayed with us and are listening to make some closing comments, and I do want to use part of the remaining time to play the speech by Dr. Martin Luther King, but I'm not going to ask anyone to be brief. Just go ahead. If you would like to make a response, just take your time. We certainly are interested in hearing what you want to present. So we'll start with you, Mr. Piyaki. Would you like to respond to Minister Jesus Muhammad Ali?
No, it's 8 o'clock. Get out
yes,
of here.
Okay.
These conversations
okay, well,
go on all the time. All right.
Yeah, we certainly appreciate you spending this time with us, and we pray that you could have a come down to Louisiana and that the weather stays good, and he just left us. So, Sister Bianchi, would you like to make a comment responding to Minister Jesus Ali? Okay, I don't know if Sister Diana, even though I see she's still got the line connected to the show, I don't know if she's still with us. So what we're going to do at this time, we thank all of you who have joined us. We're not closing out the show by any means, but what we are getting ready to do now is to now go and to play for our audience, our global audience. Hopefully we'll have no technical difficulties. We're going to try to bring up the speech by Dr. Martin Luther King. And Brother Minister, just let me, I'll call you after the show so we can continue our conversation.
Yes, sir. I look forward to hearing from you. Thank you. That's what I'm like.
Okay.
And thank
you,
everyone.
Go ahead. Thank you. Okay, there's a commercial here before.
Like an invisible ring. It doesn't sound correct, but in pieces, I have.
Here we go.
And help welcome our honored, distinguished guest, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King.
Principal Fornese, Mr. Williams, members of the faculty and members of the student body of Barrett Junior High School, ladies and gentlemen. I did not pause to say how very delighted I am to be here today and to have the opportunity of taking a brief break in pretty busy schedule at the City of Philadelphia to share with you the students of Barrett Junior High School. And I want to express my personal appreciation to the principal and the administration for inviting me and for giving me the opportunity to see this very fine and enthusiastic group of students here at Barrett. I guess I ought to start off with a commercial. And that is, tonight, we're going to have a great night in the City of Philadelphia at Spectrum. I know you've heard of that new impressive structure called the Spectrum. And I know you've heard of Arabella Parker and Aretha Franklin, Nipsey Russell, and Sidney Poitier, and all of these other great and outstanding artists. They're going to be here tonight at the Spectrum. And I hope that each of you will come home and tell your parents to be there tonight for this great freedom festival. And I hope you will come also, for it will be a great experience. And by coming, human being supported of the birth of the civil rights movement. Now that I've got the commercial out of the way, I move on and to say some things that I want to say very briefly. And I'm being very honest, I'm going to be brief because I have other engagements. I don't have a tradition of preaching. We can talk a long time. But I'm going to really be brief today. I want to ask you a question. That is, what is in your life's blueprint? This is the most important and crucial period of your lives for what you do now and what you decide now at this age. May well determine which way your life shall go. And whatever building is constructed, you usually have an architect who draws a blueprint. And that blueprint serves as the pattern, as the guide, as the model for those who are to build the building. And a building is not well erected without a good, sound, and solid blueprint. Now, each of you is in the process of building the structure of your life. And the question is whether you have a proper, a solid, and a sound blueprint. And I want to suggest some of the things that should be in your life's blueprint. Number one in your life's blueprint should be a deep belief in your own dignity, your own worth, and your own somebodyness. Don't allow anybody to make you feel that you are nobody. Always feel that you count. Always feel that you have worth. And always feel that your life has ultimate significance. Now, that means that you should not be ashamed of your color, that in so many instances, our society has placed a stigma on the Negro's color. You know, there are some Negroes who are ashamed of themselves. Don't be ashamed of your color. Don't be ashamed of your biological features. Somehow you must be able to say in your own lives and really believe it, I am black but beautiful. And believe it. Into purchasing cosmetics advertised to make you lighter. Neither do you need to process your hair to make it appear straight. I have good hair and is as good as anybody else's hair in the world. And we're going to do that. And be sure that you have that a principle of somebody. Secondly, in your life's blueprint, you must have and be the basic principle, the determination to achieve excellence in your various fields of endeavor. You're going to be deciding as the days and the years unfold what you will do in life, what your life's work will be. Once you discover what it will be, set out to do it, and to do it well. And I say to you, my young friends, that doors are opening to each of you. Doors of opportunity are opening to each of you that were not open to your mothers and to your fathers. And the great challenge facing you is to be ready to enter these doors as they open. Ralph Waldo Emerson, the great essayist, said in a lecture back in 1871 that if a man can write a better book, or preach a better sermon, or make a better mousetrap than his neighbor, even if he builds his house in the woods, the world will make a beaten path to his door. That hasn't always been true, but it will become increasingly true. So I would urge you to study hard, to burn the midnight oil. I would say to you, don't drop out of school, and I understand all of the sociological reasons why we often drop out of school. I urge you, in spite of your economic plight, in spite of the situation that you are forced to live so often with intolerable conditions, stay in school. And when you discover what you're going to be in life, set out to do it as if God Almighty called you at this particular moment in history to do it. And just don't set out to do a good Negro job, but do a good job that anybody could do. Don't set out to be just a good Negro doctor, a good Negro lawyer, a good Negro school teacher, a good Negro preacher, a good Negro barber, a beautician, a good Negro skilled laborer. Well, if you set out to do that, you have already flunked your matriculation exam for entrance into the University of Integration. Set out to do a good job, and do that job so well that the living, the dying of an unborn couldn't do it any better. Called your lot to be a street sweeper. Sweep streets like Michelangelo painted pictures. Sweep streets like Beethoven composed music. Sweep streets like Leontine Price sings before the Metropolitan Opera. Sweep streets like Shakespeare wrote poetry. Sweep streets so well that all the hosts of heaven and earth will have to pause and say, here lived a great street sweeper who swept his job well. If you can't be a pine on the top of the hill, be a scrub in the valley. But be the best little scrub on the side of the rim. Be a bush if you can't be a tree. If you can't be a highway, just be a trail. If you can't be the sun, be a star. For it isn't by size that you win or you fail. Be the best of whatever you are. We already have some noble examples, black men and black women, who demonstrated to us that human nature cannot be cataloged. They in their own lives have walked through long and desolate nights of oppression, and yet they have risen up and plunged against cloud-filled nights of affliction. new and blazing stars of inspiration. So from an old slave cabin of Virginia's hill, Booker T. Washington rose up to be one of America's great leaders. He lit a torch in Alabama. Darkness fled in that city. Yes, you should know this because it's in your own city. From a poverty-stricken area, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, Marian Anderson rose up to be the world's greatest contralto, so that a Toscanini could say that a voice like this comes only once in a century. And Sibelius, my roof is too low for such a voice. The Red Hills of Gordon County, Georgia. And the arms of a mother who can neither read nor write, Roland Hayes, rose up to be one of the world's great singers and carried his melodious voice into the palaces and mansions of kings and queens. From crippling circumstances, there came a George Washington Carver, a carver for himself an imperishable niche in the annals of science. There was a star in the diplomatic sky. Then came Ralph Bunce, the grandson of a slave preacher, reached up and grabbed it and allowed it to shine in his life with all of its scintillating beauty. There was a star in the athletic sky. Then came Jackie Robinson in his day and Willie Mays in his day with their powerful bats and their calm spirits. Then came Jesse Owens with his fleet and dashing feet. Then came Joe Louis and Muhammad Ali with an educated fist. All of them came to tell us that we can be somebody. And to justify the conviction of the poet, fleecy locks and black complexion cannot forfeit nature's claim. Skin may differ, but affection dwells in black and the same. If I were so tall as to reach the pole, the grass of the ocean and a span, I must be measured by my soul. The mind is the standard of the man. Finally, your life's blueprint must be a commitment to the eternal principles of beauty, love, and justice. Don't allow anybody to pull you so low as to make you hate them. Don't allow anybody to cause you to lose your self-respect to the point that you do not struggle for justice. However young you are, you have a responsibility to seek to make your nation a better nation in which to live. You have a responsibility to seek to make life better for everybody. So you must be involved in the struggle for freedom and justice. In this struggle for freedom and justice, there are many instructive things that we all can do, that we all must do. We must not give ourselves to those things which will not solve our problems. You heard the word nonviolent, and you heard the word violent. I happen to believe in nonviolence. We struggle with this method with young people and adults alike all over the South, and we have won some significant victories, and we've got to struggle with it all over the North because the problems are as serious in the North as they are in the South. I believe as we struggle with these problems, we've got to struggle with them with a method that can be militant, same time does not destroy life of God. And so our slogan must not be burn, it must be build, baby, build. people who have not believed that we can transform not yesterdays of injustice, right tomorrow's of justice and humanity. Let us keep going toward the goal of selfhood, toward the realization of the dream of brotherhood, toward the realization of the dream, understanding, goodwill. Let nobody stop us. I close by quoting once more the man that the young lady quoted. That magnificent black boy who is now passed on likes to use. One day he wrote a poem entitled Mother to Son. Mother didn't always have an umbrella right, but she uttered words of great symbolic wonder. Well, son, I'll tell you, life for me ain't been no crystal stair, it's had tacks in it. Boards drawn up places, but no carpet on the floor, bare. But all the time, I've been a climbing on and reaching landings and turning corners and sometimes going in the dark, but ain't been no light. So, boy, don't you stop now. Don't you set out on the steps because you find this kind of hard. But I'm still going, boy. I still got life for me. Ain't been no crystal stair. Well, life for none of us has been a crystal stair. We must keep moving. We must keep going. If you can't fly, run. If you can't run, walk. If you can't walk, crawl, but by all means, keep moving.
So we're closing now. We hope that you have been able to hear this.
Thank you very kindly, my friend.
We hope that you've been able to enjoy this broadcast this evening. And we're going to return to this topic from time to time because we think it is important that we think about these things. And so at this time, we're going to go ahead and we're going to close with a little musical rendition. We always love to close with this. Lift every voice and sing.